Hello and welcome to Still Any Good, the podcast where we run the risk of ruining our childhoods by revisiting fondly remembered films. My name's Robert Johnson, and tonight I'm joined by a man who's not an actor. He's a podcast star. Yes, it's Chris Webb.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm pretty good, thank you. Welcome to Rainy Garage.
Yeah, yep. We love doing these in the rain, don't we?
It makes it sound so good.
Just that real world ambiance and the... Yep. Yeah.
It's that chaos that we like.
Yeah,
it's
great. Good.
Now, I tell you something, we're not alone.
Really?
No, I know. We've been joined by a very, very special guest.
Oh.
Yeah. He is an actor, a comedian, a genuine pop star, and a very, very nice podcaster. And here's a little fact. He's the second Still Any Good guest to have snogged Olivia Colman.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's Michael Fenton Stevens. Hello.
Hello. Yes, my lips are still sore.
Wow.
I've never washed them since. That's it.
Just for reference, our other guest that snogged Olivia was Marek Larwood on an episode of Drunk History where he played Crippen.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
But it wasn't as detailed as yours.
No, well, sadly, though, I think there probably now are a long list of actors who've snogged Olivia.
She'll always remember the first.
I hope she does. I hope she does. Just occasionally. I mean, she's such a massive star now. And I worked with her, actually, on the very first television thing she did. We did an episode of a thing called People Like Us, which was a very funny thing, but you won't see it anymore because, sadly, one of the people in it got sent to prison. So there we are. That's gone. But it's very funny, and she's brilliant in it. And the moment you saw her perform, you knew. She was one of those people. I've had people like that right through my career. I did a radio series with David Tennant when he was a very young actor. He was also in an episode of People Like Us, playing a young actor. I did this radio thing and thought, oh, my God, he's so good. Mm. He's so fast. His brain is so quick. He does everything with such ease, you know, and I love watching actors like that. I love working with actors like that. It makes you just think, I've got to be absolutely at the top of my game to even match this person, to get anywhere near them, you know. And Olivia is like that. As a student, I had the same experience with Emma Thompson, and it seems I was right with all of them. They've all gone on to do amazing things, you know. I have worked occasionally with people who I've felt that about, who then haven't gone on to become famous and haven't been successful, or in fact have stopped acting. I don't think it takes away from the fact that they were brilliant. They stand out because most actors are good. Most actors know what they're doing. Some actors are not. Some you work with, you think, how on earth have you managed to stay in this profession this long and be so poor? It's genuinely true. It always amazes me.
We talk about this regularly. I think there's probably every single episode we have someone that we talk about like that.
Yeah. I'm not going to name any names, but... All right, you know.
Well, we're not in the business. We're okay. We're allowed to. It's okay.
Yeah, quite. You can.
So, thank you for joining us. You've chosen a film.
I have chosen a film.
So what have we got tonight?
It was a very easy choice. I've always quoted this as being my favourite film, probably led that way by its title, which is My Favourite Year.
It was 1954. Television was live. And Benji Stone landed the job of his dreams as a TV comedy writer. It was the year Hollywood's greatest hero swashbuckled his way onto live TV and into Benji's life.
He's blasted!
Good God, it's Renfield.
I thought he was dead.
Swan better be at every rehearsal sober, or it's your neck.
They've asked me to stay with you and help you over some of the rough spots.
Like showing up?
That's one. Another is not passing out.
What sort of heroic idiot am I this time?
A musketeer idiot.
I read that on the airplane. Very funny. Very good.
I wrote that.
Did you? Bravo, Stan. Bravo.
Hello, Mr. Stork Club. We'll be two for dinner.
Oh, no, Mr. Swan. This is exactly the way it started last time.
It's a film starring Peter O'Toole, and I always adored Peter O'Toole, thought that he's the epitome of the great classic British actor. I did once meet him, and another time I saw him, and both those occasions are incredibly memorable moments in my life. I went into a dressing room after a show, and I was working with the actor Anthony Quayle. I knocked on the door and he said, oh, I've got some friends, Mike. And he said, oh, no, actually, come and say hello. And I went in, they stood up from their chairs, and it was Richard Burton and Peter O'Toole.
Wow.
I know. That's what I said.
And they were able to stand?
Oh, yes. It was early in the evening. Okay. And they'd seen a show, so they were fine. They both have large whiskies in their hands. And Richard Burton hugged me and said, "Well done, boy. You were marvellous." And I don't think I don't think he knew what I played it or anything. He just knew what it was worth.
Yeah.
And then O'Toole looked at me and just nodded and said, "Well done, son."
Nice. Oh, that is...
This is great.
That's an amazing moment, isn't it?
So amazing. Wow. I ran out of that dressing room, ran to a telephone and rang my father because I went, "You never believe what's just happened to me." Whether they meant it or not, whether they even remembered my performance, I don't care.
Possibly not by the end of the evening, after that large whiskey.
Yeah. And another time I was walking past the Garrick Club in London, and I swear this is true, I walked past the Garrick Club with my wife and we were heading somewhere, and I became aware that something had happened in the street. You know that? You get a sense that something's going on and you've missed it. Everything seemed odd for a moment, and I realised that everybody had stopped walking, and I turned, and Peter O'Toole was walking up the steps of the Garrick Club in a cape and a fedora.
Oh, wow.
And as he got to the door, it was held open for him, and he said, "Evening, George." he was doing Macbeth in London at the time, which everybody derided as a sort of a ridiculously over-the-top performance. And that's what he does in this film. He does that sort of ridiculous, over-the-top actor's performance, but it's full of amazing subtlety as well. And that is the skill, I think, that he has. It's a very difficult thing to do. All actors at some point, if they're lucky, actors are asked to do this sort of thing. You're asked to basically play a character that is really big and therefore ought to be unbelievable, but you have to somehow find the truth in it and fill it with things that will make it real. So it's not just a loud, showy-off, noisy actor. It has to have an element there. And he does that all the way through this film. Beautifully subtle, tiny little things that make you completely believe this man. You completely believe that that is a true person and that's what he's like. He has this character that he performs for the public when he's in public. He walks a certain way when he enters the restaurant. Just everybody stops and looks and he knows they are, so he gives them what they want. The story is an old sort of B-movie actor who's done all the sort of swashbuckling films, sort of an Errol Flynn type character, in his later years is a bit of a drunk and not very trustworthy, but he gets hired to perform on the King Kaiser show, which is a Saturday night live comedy in America every night. It's the biggest show on television, and he's going to be paid enough money to pay off the inland revenue and mean that he won't get thrown out of the country. So he's doing it really just for the money. But he's completely unreliable. He drinks enormous amount. He's a terrible womanizer. And a young writer on the show is given the job of guarding him, making sure that he turns up for rehearsals and that he's there to do the show. And that's all it's about, really. Not much particularly happens, really. He goes to dinner with this young writer's family in Brooklyn. And then they just go through this very strange little week of his life. It's full of the most beautiful things. Now, I'm a very sentimental man, and I really like the idea. Now, I can see that some people say, "Oh, yeah, so you got a drunk, in the end it all turns out fine." Well, it sort of does. He knows that he's thrown his life away. Amazingly, it's actually based almost entirely on a real occurrence. Errol Flynn did perform on the Sid Caesar show, which is why the main character, or the man who runs the show, Joseph Bologna, is a brilliant performance as the central comic on this show. Particularly, there's a scene just before they do the show, the live performance, where he's panicking that he's in the wrong costume, that nobody's told him where anything is, he's got the wrong script, that sort of mania that happens because of fear. He does it so brilliantly. Anyway, he plays his character King Kaiser, who every week on the show does a sketch about the local union man, who's really a gangster, and he's under threat. So that's I'm not explaining this terribly well. Perhaps you should explain what the film is. What did you think of it?
Well, probably talk a little bit about the film itself. As you said, it's based on Sid Caesar's old show, Your Show of Shows. And this is kind of based on Mel Brooks's early life, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
The Benji Stone character is based on Mel Brooks.
And Woody Allen?
Mel Brooks / Woody Allen.
Yeah. It's a combination of both, isn't it?
Mel Brooks kind of upped the script and he sort of said it was very similar to the kind of caretaking he used to do on some of the celebrities.
Yes.
I know the other writers in the writer's room are based on Neil Simon and Mel Tolkien, even down to The Whispering.
I think that's
something that Neil Simon
thing,
used to do, yeah.
There's one of the writers who never speaks, well, he speaks right at the end of the film. But apart from
that,
he always just leans across, whispers in someone's ear, and they then repeat what he said. Herb, which is every performance in it is perfect, I think. I mean, really brilliant.
It's very funny.
It's really funny. Yeah. It's full of the most fantastic lines as well.
That, it is a good script.
That Jewish comedy. It's when he goes to visit his mother. They have lunch with his mother, and she turns up in full evening gown and pearls. And then his aunt, I think, isn't it, turns up...
in a wedding dress.
He's, yeah, turns up in full wedding dress. He says, nice dress. And she says, I've only worn it the once.
That is brilliant. It's really, really funny.
Yeah. There's also Benji Stone. She's always complaining that he doesn't keep his Jewish name, that he's changed it to Benji Stone, which is played by Mark Lynn Baker. He's sitting there and she keeps talking to Alan Swan, who is the character that Peter O'Toole plays, the film star, in a terribly intimate and friendly way. So she meets him with, Alan, Alan, welcome to my small abode.
Well, she says, welcome to my chapeau.
Chapeau, yeah. And then he says, she then abbreviates that to Al. Hey, Al, eat, have some liver. And then she's talking to him. She says, Swanee. And the line is, it's a beautifully written line, but it just comes and goes. And that's what I like about this film. There's so many beautiful things. She says, Swanee. And Benji character says, my, he's a film star, not a river. It's beautiful. Beautiful.
One of the things I really liked about it is the first act, if you like, is the chaos of the writer's room and putting the show together. Mm. Is that something that you could relate to from some of the live TV that you've done, like Who Dares Wins or even Spitting Image?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Was it actually like that?
My very first experience of television was when I came down as a student and I did an appearance on Not the 9 o'clock News with Rowan Atkinson and others. And John Lloyd had invited me down to do it. And it was to get experience of performing in front of an audience because I was a student and we were about to do some television stuff. It was ridiculous, really. And he then said, oh, come and see if you've got any ideas for the news lines. We'd have to write these, and in the news this week. And we just sat around a table and there were about 10 people sitting around all just going, what about that? Oh, this story, what about that? And just saying lines. The rule was if over half the people laughed at it, then it went in for consideration. If under half laughed, it wasn't funny enough. And it was madness. But great fun. They had a place called the Writer's Room at the BBC Radio, BBC Light Entertainment Department of the BBC Radio, which was through my early years, full of all sorts of, was Griffith Jones and then Hugh Dennis and Steve Punt and Andy Hamilton. Mm-hmm. All sorts of people went through that room writing for things like the News Quiz and the News Headlines, those sort of shows. Some people on typewriters and other people scribbling away and then other people shouting at each other. It was just a room full of writers all trying to write. It's mad. I can't write unless I go and sit in a corner on my own quietly. I think it does reflect that. Yeah. And his appearance in that thing is one of the... He comes in with his hat. Good evening, gentlemen. Good morrow, I think you might even say. Something like that. It's just so sort of actory. And the fellow says, oh, my God, the guy's a drunk. What? Look at him. And he says, if I were drunk, could I do this? And he does a forward roll on the table and his legs go either side of the projector, which is there. And then he passes out.
That's great.
I've always wanted to do it. I've always wanted to walk into a room and say, if I were drunk, could I do this?
I could never do that because I've always been too scared to do a forward roll. I don't know where to put my neck.
It hurts. Forward rolls really hurt.
I almost think that would be his idea. They'd say, you then do something. What can you do? And he said, well, I can do a forward roll. And they said, well, can you do that? You might make sure your legs don't hit the projector. He said, oh, no, I'll be fine. And it's ridiculous. I mean, he's quite old at that point.
He's 50, I think.
Yeah.
He's 50, but he sort of looks a bit more withered than 50.
He does, yeah. Yeah, he's at 50, people look when they were 50 in the olden days, where they looked about 70.
Yeah, absolutely.
But his eyes still twinkle.
It's a big twinkle. Yeah. Really, yeah. And he's clearly done that in an inappropriate place before, hasn't he? You can tell.
Almost certainly. It was an anecdote he told them.
Yeah. So, had you seen this before, Rob?
I hadn't seen the whole film before. I'd seen glimpses of it sort of on TV when I was about 10 or 11. And it never really kind of appealed to me when I was more interested in genre films and action films and things at that time. The only thing that I actually... that caught my attention at the time was Cousin Larry.
Oh, from Perfect
from
Strangers.
Perfect Strangers.
Yeah. Who Martin was, Baker, yeah.
That's how I knew Martin Baker. that certainly resonated more for me than Peter O'Toole at the time. You know, it just hasn't been part of my cultural landscape, really, and it doesn't feel like it's embedded itself, certainly here in New Zealand, as a classic that people go back to.
No, I mean, it's almost forgotten, really, I think. And the fact that, you know, O'Toole was nominated for an Oscar for the performance, which is very unusual because it's not a big showy film. It's a very small film. It's quite short. Mm. It's just a simple story, which is quite heartwarming. I wouldn't say there's anything momentous about it, but it's just, to me, it works perfectly for what it's supposed to be. It does exactly what it's supposed to do.
One of his many nominations, wasn't it? That
he was nominated the year before for The Stuntman, I think, and then he was nominated again.
I think the day that Richard Benjamin offered Peter O'Toole the role, he had been nominated in 1980 for The Stuntman. And then Mel Brooks apparently said to Richard Benjamin, "You idiot, don't you realise how much he's going to cost us now?" Yeah, so it was very interesting revisiting this. Like you say, Michael, it's a film that has disappeared somewhat.
And it is absolutely, it's full of people that you sort of go, oh, I know them from somewhere, but they're not famous. None of them are particularly famous. And then none of them went on to become famous. They were in this really big film at the time. I mean, I think it was third on the box office, from what I've read about. It was third in the American box office when it was released, behind some really huge films that were released at the same time.
The 18th week of E.T.
Exactly, So it was E.T. was out. Yeah. And, you know, so it did fantastically well, and yet it rose and then has disappeared. And all those actors, very few of them went on to do, you know, they had careers in America, which, you know, if you have a career in America, you do quite well.
Yeah.
But, you know, Jessica Harper, I think, was in a few other nice roles and what have you, but to a large extent, her latter career has been writing children's books. She did marry a top executive at one of the film companies, so, you know.
She's done all right.
Yeah. I think the last thing I saw her in was Minority Report.
Oh, yes.
I mean, but, you know, all those characters, all the characters it's staffed with and filled with all around, everybody playing sort of maitre d's and people in hotels, and all of them are just, you sort of go, I think we went to the hotel and found the actual maitre d', or they found the actual waiter. These are real people. You absolutely believe that all of them are people in New York working, and this man cuts through their life and affects it. You know?
There's some great character actors in there, aren't there?
Yeah, people, Cameron Mitchell, obviously, from the old Western TV series, and Gloria Stewart. And I think the Wardrobe Girl was one of the original writers on Your Show of Shows.
That's right, yeah. Selma Diamond.
Selma Diamond.
What a name, eh? Selma Diamond, yeah. Yes, she was actually one of the writers. She plays the wardrobe mistress with a cigarette hanging out of her mouth the whole time.
And that amazing voice.
And an enormously long piece of ash on the end of it that you're waiting to see fall. And it just doesn't.
That's a talent.
It is. I don't know. You know, Norman, the writer, didn't go on to enormous successes afterwards. So it's one of those things that just sort of popped up.
Yeah.
And then that was it. I don't know why I fell in love with it at the time. I went to see it at the cinema. I think probably because of O'Toole. There are things he does in it that are quite astonishing. There's a moment where he goes to see his daughter and he's sitting in the back of the car and he's looking out at the thing. And you know, you can see the joy in his face of seeing his daughter come out of the house, get on the bicycle. But you also, as an actor, I know he's not looking at that. There's a camera crew there.
Yeah, that's right.
And he, in his head, is seeing his daughter. They say, "What are you looking at here, Peter?" Your daughter comes out of the house, she gets on her bicycle, she rides around with her friend, and then she rides towards the car. And as she rides toward the car, you go, "Oh, I'm not sure I want her to see me. I'm not brave enough for that." So just sit back in the car. And he does this very slow thing where he's looking, his face is absolutely full of pride and joy at seeing his daughter that he hasn't seen for over a year, that he feels very guilty about not having seen, but he adores. You can see all that in his face. And then you see the fear, and then you see him slowly turn. He looks away from the scene, and he sits back in his chair. It's masterful. It's a moment that's worth stopping and watching again for the skill of it, the skill of what he does. He tells the whole story, and at the very end of the film, where he's standing there, and they do in slow motion of him waving the sword above his head in front of an audience that's cheering and clapping and going mad. As an actor, again, the chances are there was no audience there.
Yeah,
this was him alone on a set, and they said, "Now imagine the audience are doing this." And that, to me, shows you what sort of an actor he was, the skill of it, because you completely believe those things. Yeah. There's a moment in it as well. I know he, you know, he's a well-practiced drunk, but being something and then acting it is not the same thing. Having done something doesn't mean you can necessarily reproduce it when you're asked to act it. Some actors sort of go, well, it's good to have gone through these things because I can then, you know, I can then feed off it and use it when I have to perform it. And I'm not necessarily sure that all actors work that way. You know, otherwise, I don't know. They're also, well, how could you play a murderer? I don't know. I haven't done it, so I obviously can't know what it's like. He was a, you know, he's famous for having drunk a lot and being drunk on many occasions. But he seems to be able to reproduce that without being drunk. You're completely convinced by his drunkenness. It's a very, very, it's almost the most difficult thing to do.
Oh, it is. It can go wrong very easily, can't it?
Oh, you can look absolutely drunk. Ridiculous trying to look drunk. Yeah. The skill, really, of anybody who's drunk, and I think you remember when you are playing a drunk, I think, is that everybody who's drunk doesn't really think they're drunk.
Yeah, they pretend not to be,
You make every effort to not look drunk. You don't want to fall around. You don't want to slur your words. That all happens accidentally, and you never intend it. So you're trying to control it. So if anything, when a drunk talks, they become a little bit more deliberate. I once asked Bill Nighy if he thought that his acting style was based on the fact that when he first started to act, he was a drunk. Which is a bold thing to do, because he could have gone, fuck off. But he didn't.
Fuck off.
He didn't. He went, you may be right. Because Bill Nighy does this very stumbly sort of thing where he will take a rush at something and do something for a bit, but he has unusual pauses in it. He stops at the unusual places. And to me, that's the voice of a drunk. And I don't know if he sort of developed his acting style. I mean, he's a fantastic actor. But I wonder if there you can see in it an element that may have been developed when he used to drink. I've got to go on stage, but I am, you know, I've had a few. So, in fact,
I'm not going to be able to not think that when I see Bill Nighy perform now.
I know it does slightly ruin it for you. Know? And he hasn't drunk for years, but it's sort of built into his performing. But there's a bit in this where Peter O'Toole is a drunk, and they're on top of the building and they have to get to the party on the floor below. He says, we need to get down there. And he says, what we need is a rope. And he turns and he sees this hose hanging off the wall.
Like fire hose,
A fire hose hanging off the wall. And he goes, aha! And he goes towards it, but he walks backwards. So you see what watch it again for that moment, because it's quite extraordinary. His whole momentum is to go towards the rope, and he walks backwards. He loses his balance. It's really fantastic. I watched it, thought, I've practiced it. Because it's so skillful. I've looked at it and gone, if I'm ever, I'm going to do that. I'm going to try and copy that. Because it says drunk instantly.
Billy Connolly's instruction always makes me laugh on how to act drunk is you try and walk with one foot glued to the floor. So you're just moving around. And that works.
Yes, there is that thing. He's sort of, he's like a little foal that's just been born. As he stands, he's surprised at the fact that he's up, and his legs go, you know, astride. They splay out a bit in order to. Oh, it's amazing. To me, as an actor, the thing is so full of that, those skillful moments. The little speech that King Kaiser makes at the end of the final rehearsal before the next day they're going to do the live show. He makes a little speech. I thought you'd be difficult. I thought, you know, you're the man's a bum.
Yeah.
But, I'm a fan. I grew up watching your films, and, it's been good. And it's so lovely.
And you're funny.
Yeah.
You're funny. And to him, he's paying him the highest compliment. I'm a funny man. Yeah. I know I'm funny. I get laughs every week. And you turn up and you can do it. You can do the funny. That's good. Yeah. In my book, that makes you a good man. It's really, really good.
But also because King Kaiser, you know, he's such an angry hard ass throughout the whole thing. He doesn't take crap from anyone.
Yeah.
For him to actually say, I like what you do, and say it quite tenderly, that's a huge thing for him to do. You know, it's very sincere for him as well.
He's like a bashful child.
Yeah,
wasn't
absolutely.
It?
Yeah. And again, it's very much like Sid Caesar used to be. There's lots of reports of Sid Caesar being quite tough in the writer's room. There's an instance where Mel Brooks complained about the cigar smoke and they were on the first floor writing and he just held him by the belt and held him out the window and said, is that enough air for you?
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Terrifying.
I think he was quite troubling, yeah.
Yeah. To completely ruin the film, we ought to go through the entire story. There is the fantastic moment right at the end where he, Alan Swan, turns up. He's been out drinking all night and everything, but he's completely in control. He's ready to go on set. He's wearing his musketeer's outfit. He has his wig on. He looks fantastic, and he's completely ready. And he says to Benji, you know, normally I don't really start performing until about the third or fourth take, but, you know, I think I might get this on the very first take. And Benji says, well, you know, you're going to have to, because, I mean, it's live. And he says, sorry? Yeah. He says, it's live. He goes, live? And he runs in complete panic. I haven't performed live since the repertory company in 19... Oh, it's just it's the collapse of this man's confidence.
It's where he says, is it, last time I performed live, I played a butler. I had one line. I forgot it.
I forgot it. That's it. That's it. And yet, well, quite every moment, the writing of the joke is always brilliant. But it's in the middle of this real drama, I think. You know, the emotions are all there, and they've got these fantastically funny lines to say as well. They are believable. You believe that he said those things. It's really lovely. It's a lovely film.
And Chris, you've seen this before, I take it?
I had. The strange thing was, I'd seen that forward roll probably about 50 times, because it used to be on the opening credits of Barry Norman's film 82.
Oh, yeah.
And so I always remember that forward roll, because there'd be little clips of films, and he reviewed it and said it was good. I don't remember when I did see it, but I definitely had seen it, because a lot of this stuff came back to me when I watched it again. Yeah. I do remember enjoying it, because at the time, 1982, I was 11, so I was just getting into things like Mel Brooks and Woody Allen. I'd see things like The Sunshine Boys, and this fitted in really, really nicely with that. And you're right, Mike, it just disappeared. Until you mentioned it, I thought, oh yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
So it was a treat to dip back into it. I think I appreciated it a lot more this time.
I mean, it really would work, wouldn't it? It's one of those films that they could show on a Sunday, you know, wet Sunday afternoon like they do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Everybody would go, what a lovely film.
Not going to offend anyone, really.
Why? I don't know why. I mean, quite often with these, there'll be a simple reason. For example, somewhere along the line when they did the deal for selling the movie to television things, they priced it too high or something. And the television companies have gone, well, not that one, because every time we show that, it costs us $50,000.
Yeah.
So, you know.
There is some slightly sex-pesty behaviour from Benji.
At the beginning, especially, He's a bit over-eager.
I mean, it's of its time. It's not only 1982, it's set in the 50s. So, in fact,
54,
all the women in it are absolutely, you know, supposedly just there to help the men. And it's even extraordinary that at that time that they did... And in the film, do have a woman writer in the room. You know, it's fairly progressive in that way, but she's not really taken any notice of.
No, but she feels like a real person.
Yeah.
There's that sort of allusion to King Kaiser. Was it days to buy some shoes?
Yes, that's right.
But she sent them back, and you kind of get this feeling that he might have tried it on with her, but she's not really...
That's kind of apparent the whole way through.
He's doing it the whole way through.
Do a good show tonight. Yeah. There's all this sort of stuff.
And also the fact that Peter O'Toole's character, just everywhere he goes, every woman looks at him as if she immediately would say yes if he said, you want to go to bed? And in fact, clearly some of them do. Again, it's a mad idea, but I slightly suspect that Errol Flynn in 1952, you know, to a large extent had that power. That ability to say to women, well, I'm Errol Flynn, you want to sleep with me? And lots of people would have gone, well, yeah, I'd quite like to sleep with Errol Flynn, even though you're 30 years older than you were when I imagined you. But I don't know.
And Peter O'Toole, you know, he oozes charm and charisma. I mean, even though he's looking slightly haggard.
He's still got the eyes.
He's got the eyes. He's just, his smile... It's such a warm performance.
Yeah.
And he's just so charming.
Yeah, he plays charming because he obviously was charming in real life, but he does it so, it's really convincing.
He's got an amazing career, right? It's just like, just looking through his filmography. He's kind of an actor who I never sort of think of him when I think of the greats.
No.
But he truly is one of them, you know. I mean, nominated, what, 7 or 8 times?
I think it was 8 after Venus.
Amazing, isn't it?
And you go through his filmography, amazing roles, and a variety of them as well. And it deserved the nomination for this one, too.
Definitely.
The range that he shows in this.
Yeah, I think so. I think he is one of the great actors of the last century, certainly. As far as his film performances are concerned, I think he's ahead of Olivier. Although, you know, the very few performances in the history of film that beat... Is it safe? Is it safe? Is it safe? Yeah. Is it safe? Yeah. Is it safe? Just one of the most terrifying things on film, the casual nature of I'm going to cause you enormous pain, and I'm just going to keep saying this question until you give me the answer I want. Really horrible. Mm. Film lovers will know what we're talking about, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, we've actually done that.
I think that was about episode 38.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that may well...
It's incredible.
That could easily be on my list. It's a fabulous film, you know.
I can't remember I heard it now. I think it was on something like Desert Island Discs that Hoffman said that in between takes, just to build up his stamina and look like he was a marathon runner, he used to just constantly jump rope for like about 45 minutes while they were setting up the next shot.
Mm.
And that's just madness. That's insanity.
Yeah. Yeah.
You wouldn't do that, would you, Mike?
Now I look back on my younger self and go, I did. I remember doing it. Remember days ago, I played Ferdinand in The Tempest, and the second act of the play started with Ferdinand carrying his logs onto the set, and they'd said, we won't make you force logs, we'll give you big logs to carry, so it looks like you're carrying something heavy. And I said, well, he's discovered carrying logs, so he will have already carried logs, won't he? So in the interval, I used to stand all through the interval in the wings, picking up these logs and putting them down, picking them up and putting them down, so that by the time I brought them on stage, I was A, exhausted, and B, pouring with sweat and looked like a man who'd been carrying logs, rather than just getting a spray and spraying myself and walking on, which I'm sure would have been just as convincing. But I rather like the idea of, I sort of indulged myself in the fact that, you know, in order to get the true performance, I needed to do this. I wouldn't do it now.
What would Larry Olivier have said, eh?
Oh.
Well, I know somebody who worked with him and played, this is Anthony Quayle, who told me, this is from the horse's mouth. Anthony Quayle told me that when he played Laertes to Olivier's Hamlet at the Old Vic, and Peggy Ashcroft was playing Ophelia, he was on stage, did the scene with her, and she does the madness scene where she's doing a thing, and Tony said that he came off stage and she'd been so amazing that night, and it was so an astonishing performance. Suddenly she just upped it. It was completely convincing, and he said it made him cry, and he came off stage crying, and Larry Olivier was standing in the wings waiting to go on, and he stopped him, grabbed him by the arm, said, are you all right? He said, no, I'm sorry, she was just so, it was amazing. I got completely carried away with what she was doing. And Olivier said, they can't see that. And he was referring to the audience. I think that's a very telling peek into the way that Olivier worked. If the audience can't see it, there's no point in doing it. And that may well be true. I've done that. I've done performances, again, in a production of Hamlet. I played Horatio. And at the end, as they're carrying off, you know, the rest is silence. I was there, tears rolling down my face. Very proud of the fact that I was crying every night. What an achievement. And my wife came to see it, and I said, all right, did you like it? She said, yeah, very good, very good. She never makes much fuss about these things. And then I said, I was crying at the end. She said, were you? And then you feel like an arse. And then you sort of go, well, yeah, Larry's right. He's absolutely wrong. What's the fucking point of that? You know, they can't see it. It's all for you. It's all just your ego, you know.
There might have been some imperceptible sort of energy, though, that you...
You're imbuing the role, you
know?
Yeah.
Maybe not. I don't know. I mean, you know. Actually, if you know, if anybody is thinking of becoming an actor, all the actors I know who are the most successful are the people who, to a large extent, do what they think is right for their performance in a show. And they very rarely think about anybody else's, what are you doing? What are you doing at that point? What am I doing?
Yeah.
They just go, this is what I would do. This is what my character would do, which is very like real life, in fact. They plough a furrow that is very solitary. And that, quite often, is where extraordinary performances are developed, because they're only thinking about themselves. Now, that's not because they are selfish people, but I think that actually in life you can only control what you do. They're sort of applying to acting what you do in real life, and I think that's to a large extent what makes their performances extraordinary. So my advice to actors, if you're going to be on stage, is be selfish. You won't be liked by every other actor. Because that's what people are. People quite often, you know, you don't know what other people are thinking. And to sort of go, well, I do know in this because I've read the script, is cheating. You wouldn't know what they were going to say.
It's interesting, isn't it? There's been a lot of discussion in recent years about so-called method acting and a lot of critique of it. I'm thinking most recently sort of Jeremy Strong. I don't know if you watch Succession, Mike.
I unfortunately, no, I'm a man who will spend very little money on watching television. So I've been in a number of things recently over the last few years that I haven't seen. Because I don't have Apple TV, I don't have Disney Plus, I don't have, you know, so I haven't seen them. They're the best paid jobs, but I've not seen them.
I think it's a Vanity Fair article, or maybe a GQ article about his method acting.
Mm-hmm.
Some of his co-stars, like Brian Cox and Rory Culkin and stuff, who basically said, we really struggle with his method. And it kind of made him look a bit foolish, actually, and there's a little bit of a controversy around it. Jared Leto as the Joker. I mean, the whole method thing has kind of been...
I mean, the thing about not knowing what everyone else is going to say, I know we talked about it during our Superman the movie episode, because I know that was the approach that Brando took.
Yeah.
Was that when he did his very, very small part, all he wanted was his lines. He wanted everything said to him to be delivered as if it was the first time.
Yeah.
So he insisted on it being delivered to him the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what you're talking about, just insisting on not knowing what anyone else is going to
say. No. Yeah. Who's the actor in on the waterfront with the... very large, bulbous nose.
Rod Steiger?
No, I don't think it is. Maybe it is Steiger, but maybe that's who I'm thinking of. There's a scene of the two of them in the back of a cab having a conversation, and I read somewhere that when they filmed it, they filmed Brando first. So they did the two shot, and then they did the close-up on Brando, and then they turned the camera around to film Steiger's thing, and Brando had gone. He said, I'm not in shot, I'm not involved in this scene. I don't need to do it anymore. In acting, that scene is almost... you know, the worst thing you can do to not... people often say that the best performance they give is on the reverse because you're doing it to help the other actor. And also, I think he talked about a moment where they said, OK, turnover, speed, rolling, action. And it was about 2 or 3 minutes before Brando spoke. He just sat there and stared at him. After he said to him, you're right, could you not remember it? And he said, no, I wasn't ready to say it.
Fair enough.
Well, it is fair enough. But I mean, that sort of, it has to be absolutely right. I have to feel right. I have to know what I'm going to do and I have to do it the way I want to do it. It's unusual because everybody's thinking, oh, how would people think of me? You know, or in fact, they'll think I'm useless if I just sit here. He didn't give a damn about any of that. I'm not one of those actors. I can't do that. I spend the whole time thinking about other people's performances and what they're doing. And you know, in a way, they say that acting is supposed to be reacting. And I like actors who change the way they perform each night. They do slightly different things. And it only has to be very slight for a thing that you're repeating every night and doing for months. A very small change will seem momentous when you're opposite it. And so I enjoy that process of sort of just playing with it constantly, seeing what happens. So it means that sometimes you throw away moments that absolutely are great and work incredibly well. But in a way, if you kept trying to just recreate those moments, they would die themselves. They would fade away. You have to let them go because you just can't keep repeating the same thing, I think.
Mike, I do need to ask you. It's totally off topic. Nighty Night is one of my favourite shows of all time.
Mine too.
Criminally underrated in some
ways. It was great.
Ways. You know,
really great.
I just think it's genius.
Yeah, well, she is a genius, you know. And she's one of the sweetest people, obviously with the most... wicked sense of humour. She just finds, because it's a strange writing. And I have the original scripts and they are, to a large extent, you can read through them and go, oh, there's a little bit that stayed in. Oh, there's a little bit that survived. But she was changing all the time. She was constantly, you know, in a way that thing of, well, I've written that, but I don't want to just repeat that, so I'll do something else. So every time we did a take, it was slightly different. She would change the lines. She would put lines in. If you look at that, the first series of Nighty Night, the final episode where they poison me as the vicar and I slowly die because of Angel Delight. Mark Gatiss wasn't in the series before that. He filmed all his stuff after the series finished.
Oh, really? Wow.
He was
brought, that character?
Somebody else played it. It's a very weird thing.
Oh, wow.
So, I would never have noticed that.
We filmed that last bit about 4 months after we'd finished filming. I had to get my hair cut so that it looked the same, and we went and we filmed it in Steve Coogan's house. And so that's where we were. It was months after, because she had been in the studio and been in the editing and trying to put it together as a series, and went, I haven't written an end. I don't know why. So she wrote a final episode to tie it all together, scenes that would bring it all together and tie it off. And we had to film those later. I've never worked like it before. It was amazing.
Wow.
She would suddenly say, oh, I've got this idea. We're going to do a sort of sitting around the dinner table. And we said, well, what do we say? And she said, well, you know, to a large extent, don't say anything. Just react. And so you didn't know what was going to happen. It was really fabulous. And the only thing you couldn't do, of course, was laugh. You just had to sit there and be embarrassed. And she would push the embarrassment level, particularly if the camera was on you. She would then push with the line she was saying, and it wasn't on her, so it wasn't filming. She would just go off on some sort of improvisation, which was bizarre and weird, and you'd have to sit there going, mm-hmm, yeah. Oh, that's, oh, right, yes, with a melon. Mm. Just amazing. It was really, really brilliant fun.
It was a brilliant show.
The people who know it love it. They read the people who found it.
Yeah. And, oh, yes. You know. It's easily one of the best comedies of the last 20 years. Easily.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I was over the moon to get... I auditioned for hours and hours and hours. We auditioned for that. Her way of auditioning for people was really... We went in a room and she said, so you're the vicar, Gordon, and I'm this woman who's a parishioner who's just come into your parish, and we'll just let's see where it goes, okay? She would start talking, and then you'd start talking. You'd say, oh, really? Well, welcome to the parish. Oh, it's lovely. Where are you living? And we talked, and we did that, and she filmed it. I'd love to see them, because we did one that was about 2.5 hours.
Wow.
And then finally, she laughed. She got the giggles and said, oh, we'll have to stop. but we improvised for hours and hours.
Very good.
And then, you know, she sort of went, no, I can work with this person. This is, you know, this will work. So I was thrilled, absolutely thrilled to get it.
Terrific stuff. You had to ask that, didn't you?
I did.
You needed to know.
Yeah. I did. Because I just sort of discovered it almost by accident.
Mm-hmm.
And couldn't believe what I was watching, actually.
No.
I got absolutely addicted to it. And so yes, I'm always recommending it to people.
Have you seen Human Remains, the series you did?
Yes. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Rob Brydon, yeah. Fantastic. It's
fantastic. Fantastic comedy. She's unique, I think. She really is. The fact that
Very much so.
She performs like nobody else. Her humour is her own humour. Yeah. You either get it or you don't. You go along with it or you don't get it. You think, what?
Her podcast, Dear June and Jericho.
Oh, my word.
One of the funniest things I think I've ever heard.
Oh, my God.
It's filthy.
It's really filthy.
It's so funny. It's really brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, the two of them are fabulous, aren't they? Yeah. Happy days. There we are.
Yes. Well, we've gone off topic quite a lot, which is fine.
That's absolutely fine.
We could possibly get to that point of it then, because I think we've talked a lot about the film. So this is the stage, Mike, where we kind of go around the table and ask that question. So we'll come to you first. So, Mike, do you think that My Favourite Year is still any good?
Yeah, it's still my favourite film. It still is. It beats all those other ones. It beats Star Wars. It beats Indiana Jones, the first one. It even beats It's a Wonderful Life, which is not easy.
No, because I've heard you talk about how much you love that film.
I do love that film. I really love that film, yeah. But no, I think for me, if I had to say, you know, the one film that I would be happy to keep watching over and over. I have watched It's a Wonderful Life. You know, to be honest about it, there are moments in it where I think, yeah, you can get on with it now. Come on.
It's bleak.
It's bleak.
Also, the structure. It's three acts, but the last two acts are in the last 10 minutes. It's a strange structure.
Yeah, very weird. Very weird. Yeah. But, you know... A glorious film, really, for its last 10 minutes, I think. You know?
Yeah.
What about you, Robert? Did you enjoy it?
I did enjoy it, yes. I really, really liked it. Thought it sort of zipped along. It wasn't quite what I expected from that setup in the initial first act. I thought it was going to be kind of one type of thing, more of that kind of behind the scenes. It is kind of plotless, but, you know, I think Mark Lynn Baker actually does a really good job as well.
Mm-mm.
And I mean, he's had a perfectly respectable career, but you do kind of wonder if he hadn't sort of gone into Perfect Strangers for 7 years, and then, you know, he's done all sorts of things, directing and stage and stuff, but yeah, there's potentially a sort of a film career he missed out on there.
Yeah.
But you know, I really enjoyed it. Good natured, nice, warm, fun. The fact's only 92 minutes works in its favour.
Yep.
And yeah, Peter O'Toole was just hugely engaging, charming, charismatic. Yeah, enjoyed it.
Good.
What about you, Chris?
I can't really argue with anything. I liked everything about it. I thought the script was fabulous. So many one-liners. For a film which, as we've sort of said, isn't that sort of well-remembered, I went on to IMDb and looked at the quotes, and there's about 100 memorable quotes in there. And for such a kind of relatively small or minor film, that's quite something. And they are all absolute bangers. It feels like a stage play. I know it was a Broadway play afterwards with Tim Curry.
Tim Curry, yeah.
A musical, in fact, I think, wasn't it?
It was a musical. Wow. Okay. Yeah.
Didn't do very well, though, did it?
No,
not really. Not. Although they all, nearly everybody who performed in it, amazingly won Tonys for their performances in it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's amazing. Mm. But that's not to its detriment that it feels like a stage play, because it's just got so much energy and there's always something going on.
Yeah.
It's very, very chaotic, and I like that. Peter O'Toole, obviously, really, really good. As you said, Mark Lynn Baker. But even the supporting characters,
they're all
like his family,
they're great.
Amazing. Yeah, yeah. I think my favourite scene is the dinner scene.
Yeah.
Because it's just so funny. The fact that more and more people turn up to say hello, and Aunt Sadie turns up.
Filipino stepfather.
The Filipino boxer stepfather. He talks about cooking parrots. It's just
apparently
wonderful.
Based on a real character.
It is based on a real boxer,
He keeps calling him Carioca.
Yeah.
Carioca. Carioca. It's really brilliant. I love that little moment where Peter O'Toole goes, I knew a boxer, and he remembers his career. Whether he does or not, I don't know. But, I mean, it's that thing of just going straight in, and this man then goes, I adore you. You remember, saw me fight? Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And everybody else is constantly deriding this career, you know. The man who thinks he could have been a contender.
Yeah. Oh, we're back to On the Waterfront again. Yeah. But it was just very, very good. It was really, really charming.
It was.
For a debut direction from Richard Benjamin.
Mm.
Does very, very well. I know he was assisted a lot by Mel Brooks, but you know, he clearly directed it himself. We know that because he went on to do some more sort of marquee films, things like Mermaids.
Yeah,
and
Mermaids.
Money,
I really like Mermaids.
Mermaids is good, So, I really, really enjoyed it. And like you said, if it was on telly on a Sunday afternoon, I'd definitely sit down and watch it again, because it made me laugh out loud a hell of a lot.
Yeah.
I thought it was just really, really nice and really, really touching.
Yeah.
So, three goods.
Good. Well, I'm delighted that I've set you the task of watching this film and you enjoyed it.
Yes, thank you.
Definitely, yeah. We'll get
I'm
you back in 16 minutes, Okay, thank you so much, Mike. Before we let you go and enjoy the rest of your morning, is there anything that you'd like to plug?
Well, I'm just about to go to Guadeloupe, which is nice. I'm going to do Death in Paradise.
Oh, really?
Which is every actor's dream job, because you go to somewhere and film, and then you have 2 days off, and then you do another scene, and then you have 3 days off. And so you're basically on this beautiful paradise island. So I'm a very lucky man, but I spend the rest of my time doing my podcast with my son, which is why I'm so enthusiastic about it. And I've had a fabulous time. We're just coming up to our 300th episode, which
is amazing.
Fantastic. Amazing. I can't believe we've got there. And we've had some really lovely people on it, and it's turned out to be something that I didn't expect it to be. When we started, we both thought it was going to be a very light-hearted, comedic look at things from people's lives, that they would find 5 funny anecdotes and tell us them. And then we'd go, thank you very much, that was very amusing. But actually, it's called My Time Capsule, and I ask people to put 5 things from their life that they would wish they had in a time capsule. They pick 5 of those things, 4 things that they love and 1 that they want to bury and forget. And people have chosen the most extraordinary things and told me the most moving, quite often disturbing things about their lives. And the fact that people have trusted me with those stories and have opened up in the way that they have is really rewarding and terribly complimentary, I think. Now, anybody who's listened to this podcast will not believe that I do a podcast where most of the time I sit and listen.
You just read my mind, because I think we can all agree you're a fucking good talker. But you do. You just let them talk.
Yeah.
And it's really, I am a listener.
I was listening to
your one with our mutual friend Margaret. I was listening to Margaret K. Vaughan Smith. We've had her on here. She's been on here.
She's great.
She is lovely. Yeah. We love Margaret. And so it's a really, really nice listen. I think it was Stephen Fry that when he was on Room 101, he said, why can't you have a room lovely?
Yeah.
I think that's what you've got.
And Stephen was the very first person to do it. When I had the idea, I thought, well, let's aim high. If I'm going to do this, let's see if we can get somebody extraordinary. So I emailed Stephen and said, in fact, almost anybody, that sounds impressive, but almost anybody in the world can do it, because he's fantastically open with all his telephone numbers and where he lives and all that. It's astonishing. I don't know why he does it. But so I emailed him, and almost by return, you know, that thing where you send it off, send, and about a minute later it went, ping, what a brilliant idea. When should we do it?
Fantastic. Wonderful.
And I thought, oh, I think I may be onto a winner. It's very nice.
That's a great format.
Yeah.
I never get bored doing it. I can sit down and do. I have on some occasions done 3 recordings in a day and thought, oh, this is going to be difficult. But I don't get tired doing it. I don't get bored. And everybody has a different story to tell. And there are different tones to each of them. Sometimes I just sit and I laugh for an hour. people tell me are fantastically entertaining and I just have a brilliant time. And other times I sit there and think, oh my, yeah, this is really important. What they're saying is really important. I just did, done an episode, which is going out soon, with the comedian Bridget Christie, who's a fantastic stand-up comedian.
Yeah.
The best in the country, I think. I think she said maybe two funny things. The rest of it, she told me things that she really cared about. That's extraordinary.
So, yes, listeners, if you're not listening to My Time Capsule, make sure you do, because it is great. Really, really good.
Thank you.
Okay, what are we doing next?
Oh, I think it's your choice, isn't it, Chris?
It is my choice, yeah. So after this lovely chat with Mike, we're going to stay on the highbrow.
Okay.
I'm going to talk about the Stallone film Cliffhanger.
Oh, it's a cracker.
Wonderful.
Oh. Oh, yes.
So I'm looking forward to that.
I'm looking forward to that one too.
That's going to be fun. We haven't done a Stallone for a while.
No.
So, not since the day your son was born, actually.
Yeah. Yes.
Do you know, Rob's baby son was born and he did a podcast the same day.
Really? Well, there the you are. That's it. That's how it can take over your
life. Dedication. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, time to wrap it up, folks. So if you want to get in touch with us, we're on Twitter at StillAnyGoodPod.
Instagram, Still Any Good Pod.
We're also on Facebook, and if you want to email us, it's stillanygood@gmail.com. And please remember to rate and review us wherever you get your podcast from.
Thank you.
Thank Brilliant. You very much.
Lovely to talk
we'll
to
see you.
We'll
see you all soon, folks.
Cheers, all the best. Bye.
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 You know, every actor wants to be in one because it means you can spend the rest of your life just going to conferences and making money. It's yeah. easy. It's the best way to make a living is to be in a Star Wars film. Yeah. I once was in an episode, well, a series of episodes of Doctors, which is a daytime soap here in Britain, which you may have seen.
Yes.
And it's, you know, it's on in the afternoon. And I played this doctor who was basically trying to close down the surgery. So I was a baddie. I got found out in the end. But I was working with this actor who was playing the judge at the inquiry. And all the way through it, I kept thinking, I know this, I've worked with this bloke. Where have I worked with this bloke? I know him really, it's terribly recognisable. Not his face, his voice. I thought to myself, oh, we must have done a radio play together or something. And eventually I said to him, sort of over lunch, I said, have we worked together? He said, I don't think so, Mike, no. I said, I recognise you from somewhere. Am I doing that thing that you do where you think you know someone, but in fact you've seen them on the telly?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And he said, no, you won't have seen me. I said, all right. He said, although you might recognise my voice. And I said, why would I recognise your voice? He said, oh, I'll do it for you. Yes, Master Luke. And I went, oh, my God.
It was Anthony Daniels.
It was Anthony Daniels. Wow. And I hadn't recognised him.
That is so cool.
It is cool, isn't it?
Oh, wow.
And he said, I said... He was a very nice man, you know, and he said, it's nice to do some acting. I don't do much. I basically fly around the world going to Star Wars conferences and walking on stage going, oh, Lord, oh, God, help us, quick, run. And, you know, he said, and they pay me a fortune. You go, great. And, of course, he's been in every Star Wars.
Yeah.
Well, he had at that point. He'd been in every one of them.
That's brilliant. You've not been offered to turn up as a...
No.
A guard or anything? Oh.
No, that would have been nice, would it? No. No, I've been on the set. I went on the Star Wars set one morning early. So I just wandered on. I just walked in exactly what you're not supposed to do. But all actors know that, in fact, if you walk somewhere as if you're supposed to be going there, very few people will ever question it. It's a thing I learned a long time ago. I had this extraordinary experience. They had one set that had a Star Wars stage. And on another set was a Bond stage. Daniel Craig was Bond at the time. I arrived at this place incredibly early. I'd been doing a play the night before. And you know that thing when you're really knackered and you think to yourself, oh, I've got to get up, I've got to remember the lines. So, of course, I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning, summer, with the light. I woke up, oh, God, and started going through my lines in my head and thought, well, this is no good. So I got up and went to the studios, had a little pass, went in, parked the car. There's nobody there. It was completely empty. And I walked, I thought, I'll have a look around. So I went into the Bond set. I was walking back from the Bond set and walked into this corridor. Those incredibly long corridors with photographs of all the old films on the wall. So it's really interesting to walk around and have a look. Amazing place. Anyway, I walked through this. As I went through the door right at the far end of the corridor swung open. And this man, James Bond, walked through. And it was Daniel Craig in full Bond.
Oh, my word.
Tights, beautiful suit, shiny shoes, clicking his way down the corridor as he walked, obviously going to makeup or something. Normally, those sort of people would have a runner with them, but it was incredibly early. So I think that he'd come in like me and thought, I've got a big day, I'll get in, get ready. He walked towards me and I walked towards him. There's no one else in the corridor, just his feet clicking as we walked along. And we headed towards each other slowly. And the temptation to, you know, to go draw a gun or something. You know, or say, ah, we meet again, Mr. Bond. You know, it's overwhelming. And I resisted it. I absolutely resisted it. I thought, no, don't. You look like an arse. And I walked past him. As we walked past each other, he went, morning. And I went, morning.
Oh.
And we walked past each other, and that was all we said. And then about 15 paces later, he turned around and over his shoulder, he said, well played.
Did he really?
Yeah.
Because you didn't
say
it.
He knew. I think it's what's brilliant is that he knows. You know,
that's brilliant.
I'm Bond. He knows what every grown man is going through. And I think it's brilliant, having done that for so long, that he's not lost that knowledge.
Yeah.
That he's not gone, oh, for fuck's sake, leave me alone. Will you stop doing the Bond thing? You know, no, he knows that every grown man goes, oh, my God, it's James Bond.
Yeah.
Doesn't he?
I wonder if you were absentmindedly making a pistol with your hands or something. And
humming the theme.
That's what he wanted. He expected me to. He obviously was thought, oh, here we go. Here we go. I can see it in his mind. He's going to do it.
You're recording, aren't you?
I am recording, I've recorded all of this. Yeah. We are going to use that.